I call the meeting of the House Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division to order. A quorum is present. Representative Becker Finn, are you moving the approval of the minutes from February 19th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker Finn moves. Is there any discussion?
Thank you.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Minutes are approved. Members, we have a full agenda today, but before we get started, I would like to read from a House resolution. I believe Jim Leach is in the audience. If Jim could come forward before his testimony. We have a House resolution honoring the service of DNR Fish and Wildlife Division Director Jim Leach. Whereas Jim Leach, a native Minnesotan, obtained a bachelor's degree in biology with a wildlife emphasis from St. Cloud State University. He has a master's degree in zoology from the University of South Dakota and did his graduate research on trumpeter swans. And whereas in 1977, Jim began his fish and wildlife career as a laborer at the La Creek National Wildlife Refuge in South Dakota, he became a Minnesota field biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the late 1970s, working at Tamarack and Agassiz National Wildlife Refuges. Whereas he became the Fish and Wildlife Service Coordinator for the Upper Mississippi and Great Lakes Joint Venture in 1993, a position focused on improving habitat conditions for waterfowl across the Upper Mississippi River Basin, and whereas Jim put in place a strategic habitat conservation plan for waterfowl focusing limited land acquisition and restoration dollars on the most important breeding habitat for ducks and geese. And whereas for 16 years as wildlife refuge manager, he oversaw up to 18 field stations in Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, creating a focus on acquisition and habitat restoration. It's a long one here, Jim, so I'm going to keep going. And whereas in April 2016, he became the director of DNR's Fish and Wildlife Division, which included the sections of Wildlife, Fisheries, Outreach, and Administration, and is charged with managing, protecting, and regulating the state's fish and wildlife resources. And whereas, over his 37 years with Fish and Wildlife, he has forged a strong relationship with hunting and fishing organizations, tribal authorities, and other conservation groups. And whereas he has provided leadership and spearheaded efforts for the fish and wildlife using outdoor heritage dollars for acquisition, and whereas Jim, a devoted family man, and his wife, Patty, have four children, he is a lifelong hunter and angler and has passed that passion on to his son and daughters. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration of the House of Representatives of the State of Minnesota that it congratulates Director Jim Leach on his years of outstanding service and wishes him well in his retirement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It was a surprise.
Jim. And with that, we will start on presentation of the governor's budget recommendations. We have John Edmond, director of Explore Minnesota. Mr. Edmond, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Edmond. I'm the director of Explore Minnesota. I appreciate the time and the interest you have in Explore Minnesota. I'm going to present just a little bit of a quick summary of what's in the governor's budget for Explore Minnesota, provide a little context for our agency, and just talk to you a little bit about some of the things we plan on doing over the next biennium. So with that, a lot of this information you've already seen in terms of our basic overview of who we are. I just want to make sure you're grounded as as an agency. We're the state tourism promotion agency, promoting Minnesota to residents and non-residents alike, trying to basically accomplish five basic goals, including driving sustainable economic growth, providing innovative marketing, consumer reach and engagement, providing service to consumers, and enhancing collaboration with stakeholders. We're a relatively small agency, about 45 individuals with regional offices or locations throughout the state. And we're also guided by a tourism council, which is governor's appointed tourism council. It's a 28-person advisory board that provides advice and guidance to us as we carry out our programs. To give you context for what's in the governor's budget for the next biennium, the last biennium, our base budget was about $13.6 million for fiscal 18, $13.7 million for fiscal 19. There was an incentive funding, which basically says we had to bring money in from the private sector, and if we do that, we get additional dollars up to a limit of $500,000 from the general fund. There was funding for an events grants program of $900,000 for the biennium, and then a one-time appropriation of $500,000 for website or technology and enhancement, which we will be using. We've used for an audit, and we're using to develop our website for the next fiscal year, for the next calendar year, actually. This slide gives you a breakdown of our budget. The majority of our dollars is into marketing, into communications, technology, which is a huge part of how we reach consumers. What we mean by market development basically is international group industry outreach is what we do with our offices throughout the state. And we have welcome centers and partnership grants. To give a little perspective on our budget over the last several bienniums, we received a pretty good size increase in our budget after the fiscal 12-13 years, but we've been relatively flat with some minor adjustments over the last three bienniums, which really puts us about 22nd nationally if you want to see how we're doing with our competitors. The overall average tourism budget is about $18.9 million. 28 states saw an increase. Six states no change, and 13 states decreased the last fiscal year. So with that, the recommendation for the governor from the governor for Explore Minnesota, first of all, is to continue the new events grants program. He's put in $1 million per year to attract new events to Minnesota that have not been here before, and I'll give you a little more explanation of what we did last year with some of the events program. But that was a very successful program, very much in demand throughout the state. And then he proposed the same, basically the same base budget each year that we had the previous fiscal year coming up into the next biennium, which will be used for marketing promotion both domestically and internationally. And I'll talk to you a little bit about what we intend to do with that. But the rationale to continue to support Explore Minnesota, because we're a large industry, $15.3 billion industry, 270,000 full-time jobs, and almost $1 billion in sales tax every year. Our industry has grown over the last several years to the $15.3 billion that you see today. Sales tax, too, has grown to nearly $996 million in 2017. These are the last years that these dollars are available. And 270,000 full and part-time jobs that are directly in the leisure and hospitality industry that don't include those other jobs upon which our industry depends. So what we intend to do with the funds for Explore Minnesota, we do a couple of major things. I'm just going to highlight some of those things here. We have for 2019 and beyond a new creative and media strategy. You may have heard at our state tourism conference, we announced the Find Your True North campaign to really capture on the term North, because there's so much conversation about North, and we really want to own that and make a sort of unique selling proposition. We're also going to continue to build on the Only an MN focus that we've done in the past. It's been very successful. We're going to rely on some traditional marketing in core markets, but we're going much wider digitally than we've ever done before to basically leverage larger audiences, because we don't care where people are coming from. If they're interested in mountain biking or fishing, if they live in Indianapolis, if they live in Omaha, we don't really care where they're coming from. We just want them to come to Minnesota, and digitally we'll be able to do that. And so we'll also be exploring different niches with minority groups and other partnerships and grants This is just a quick sample of three little ads that you will see. And our campaign hasn't hit the consumer marketplace yet. That probably won't until April. But making sure that we represent all parts of the state, all regions, that we have ethnicity represented as well and diversity. So this is just a sample of some of the print ads that we're doing. International is still is increasingly important for Minnesota when we're talking travel and tourism. It's increased 21% from 2015 to 2021, if it's expected to. We have three new international flights now to Minnesota from Seoul, Dublin, and Mexico. And our interest from our industry in getting involved in international is higher than it's ever been. Our industry really wants to become players in the international marketplace. So we're going to be doing some consumer-focused strategies to complement our trade in markets like the UK, Germany, France, Benelux, and Nordic countries. We want to leverage these new routes in South Korea, Ireland, and Mexico, and just increase our efforts with partners both on a national level like Brand USA and state partners as well. We also want to increase our public relations. We try to pitch. It's not just consumer marketing what we do. We also really work with PR to try to pitch stories about all your regions and all parts of the state to outlets, bloggers, journalists. We want to promote diverse activities and cultural attractions throughout the state and really increase our efforts. Last year was a huge year for us. With nearly $6 billion estimated audience reach in terms of PR. So as you can see, through PR, you can be as effective even more so than with direct advertising because it's very genuine. So we want to increase our efforts there. And then we also want to support, as we have, continue to support marketing, events grants, and co-ops. Last year, we awarded about $1.6 million for marketing grants to over 120 different organizations throughout the state. 48% of those grants were received by organizations in greater Minnesota. And the events grants program, I just want to take a moment to talk about that because that is a recommendation in the governor's budget. The events grant program last year, we had $900,000 that was appropriated for the biennium. And it was supposed to last for 2 years. Because of the interest in that program, those dollars were gone at the end before we had finished the first fiscal year. So there's tremendous amount of interest in communities all throughout the state, large and small, to utilize this program to bring events to communities that haven't been there before. That's the whole idea. It's a new events grants program to bring events that haven't occurred in the past. We supported with this $900,000 last year, 9 events in greater Minnesota and 10 events in the metro area. And you probably could read this a little bit more at your leisure, but this just gives you a sample of some of the different types of events. There are large events and there are small events. There's big events like the Final Four and the Minnesota or the USA Expo, the World Cup, which is at the Lopez Foundation, which is the Jesse Diggins cross-country ski event that's coming to Minnesota, as well as many smaller events and sporting events. And this slide here just shows some of the events that have been awarded in greater Minnesota. And some of these are relatively small, but a lot of these organizations that receive these grants say they would not have been able to bring these events to their community without some assistance from the state. So that's why we're pleased that program is in the governor's budget for the next 2 years at $1 million each for each year of the biennium. I also just want to make a quick reference about equity and inclusion, and that's something that we really strive to do in everything that we're involved with in our marketing, PR. We want to do promotions with people of color, people with disabilities, LGBT, in all geographic regions and reach diverse communities. And it's not just, you know, if you'll see some of our future ads, we have a lot of diversity represented in our ads, but it's not just putting people in the ads, it's also reaching out to them in ways that they want to be reached out to welcome all sorts of different people from all throughout the world to Minnesota. We really want to strive to become a welcoming state. And then the last couple things I'll just mention. We do annually do return on investment studies to find out, does our advertising actually bring money to the state? Do people travel as a result of some touch point with Explore Minnesota? And based on this report from Longwoods International, shows how many trips, how much visitor spending, and how much incremental taxes that we generated from our advertising for a bottom line, a 10-to-1 return on investment for our advertising, which is the highest last year that we've ever received in our marketing. And then this is just the last point I'll mention. And I'm talking a lot about leisure and hospitality and the dollars that are spent and the taxes and the jobs. But there's a secondary impact, something that I call the halo effect, which basically is shown. This is from a research report that we did that says that when people travel here for tourism, and you know that yourself, they will probably tell you they had no idea Minnesota had all this to offer, whether it's the cultural attractions, outdoor attractions, et cetera. And people that are traveling here are more likely to consider Minnesota as the place either to start a business, go to school, retire. So there's this secondary benefit from travel and tourism beyond the dollars that are specifically spent in the leisure and hospitality industry. So, Mr. Chairman, that pretty much completes my report. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you or anyone else has.
Thank you, Mr. Edman. Any questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Edmonds, for being here. By the way, Middle River Goose Fest was the event of the year in 2017, so thank you for that. I'm just curious to know on your third slide, I believe it is, the governor's proposed budget, the bill that was going around and some people signed on to, how does the bill that you brought forward match up with the governor's budget proposal?
Mr. Edman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, the governor's budget here proposes $1 million for the events grant program and a flat budget. The bill that I think you're referring to is coming separately from an organization called the Minnesota Tourism Growth Coalition that feels it needs to be beyond that. So I think they're proposing $5 million above the base for that. But here I'm testifying in support of the governor's budget, which is a relatively flat budget, and I'm here to tell you, Mr. Chairman and members, that we will do a fantastic job with whatever resources that you appropriate for our agency.
Thank you.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. So you have a survey about the impact of visitation on economic development. Do you have an idea of the folks who actually came back and made Minnesota home, I guess, if that makes sense?
Mr. Edden.
I understand, Mr. Chair, Representative. Yeah, I understand your question. This basically talks about intent, that after people have traveled here, are they more likely to do that? We don't actually go back and find out, did they? There's a little base of an assumption there. I think what we're really just trying to indicate through that slide and that researcher did is that there is a connection to economic development beyond tourism, but maybe that's something we should be looking at.
Any other questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, on your $1 million a year to secure new events in Minnesota, what events are you targeting, and what are you doing to target those to get those to come here?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, when this program first began, actually last year or last biennium, when we had $900,000, it was the second year of the program. The first year there was $600,000, the biennium before that. And that was just a pilot program. And so the way this program works is that we announce to communities across the state that we will support on a matching grant program. We will provide assistance for communities to bring in new events to the state that haven't been here for at least 3 years, because we don't want to just provide funding for events that go around. And so it's the communities that basically rose up on their own. We didn't really have to do any advertising or selling. They knew that they wanted to bring in some of these events. They just weren't sure that they had the resources, but then with the assistance from the state, they were able to do that. And so there's been so many examples of plowing festival up in Baudette. Whoever would have thought of that? We never would have, but that community up in Baudette felt that that was something that they could bring to their region, and now with the assistance of this program, they were able to do it.
So. Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, when you talk about these being new, have you considered maybe looking into some of the legacy funds, arts and cultural heritage funds, for this? Because if it's new, then we won't be breaking our supplement, not supplant. And have you looked into that, or do you think that's an option, rather than general fund dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, no, we haven't really looked into that in great detail. In the past, we have looked at some different types of tourism funding out of the legacy program. But one thing about this program, it really was industry-driven. It was something that, you know, going back to things like the senior games, people came to us and said, we want help from Explore Minnesota to support these. And we said, we just don't have a mechanism by which to give grants. So then the industry rose up and said, we need to have a grant program as a part of the Explore Minnesota tourism budget. So it kind of came from the industry. In terms of the legacy program, that's something we could look at again, but that was not really where this program initially, you know, was started. But that, but it's certainly an option, I suppose.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, well, thank you for that. If you want any help looking into that, let me know. I think it'd be a good option for you.
All right, we'll do. Thank you.
Any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on the tourism budget? Thank you, Mr. Edmond. We'll go next to the Minnesota
Thank
Zoo.
Thank you, Member.
And members, we haven't received our three-ring booklets yet, so the materials that are here, we will be three-hole punching Representative Lewick, and we'll get those binders ready. So we're just not quite there yet. Welcome, Mr. Crawley.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for having the Minnesota Zoo. Myself, my name is John Frawley, director of the Minnesota Zoo. I'm glad to have this opportunity. We just met, presented to the committee not too long ago with animals. Sorry, no animals today, but covered a lot of the great work that the Minnesota Zoo is doing. And so today I'll be a little bit more brief on some of the historic information. So just to remind you, you know, we are a state zoo, the state of Minnesota Zoo, state agency. We're a zoo for all Minnesotans. We have a huge educational reach at the Minnesota Zoo. Over 90,000 school participants every year that we reach from over 1,000 schools in Minnesota. For those of Minnesotans who can't come to the zoo, we have a robust Minnesota Zoo Zoomobile program. Which is the program that came and presented to this committee a month ago, or a few weeks ago. That program this year has already reached over 43 counties, doing over, on a yearly basis, it does over 650 hours of outreach to greater Minnesota, bringing animals to hospitals, schools, community centers. We also have a huge focus, and you know that's a focus of mine as well, on access, getting people into the Minnesota Zoo. I'd like to say that we're a free zoo to Minnesotans who need us to be free. Excuse me. And that is a big focus, getting people into the zoo. We've now aligned all of our access programs with the assistance programs in the state of Minnesota. So if somebody does qualify for assistance in Minnesota, a SNAP or WIC or any of the programs, then they now come to the Minnesota Zoo for free. Since we've aligned with the assistance programs, we're on track to hit over 100,000 people for free at the Minnesota Zoo. So it's a huge successful program that we're very proud of. The mission of the Minnesota Zoo is to connect people to animals and the natural world to save wildlife. We have over 500 species of animals, over 5,000 specimens. Over 70 of them are threatened and endangered species. So we are a world-class zoo. We're known internationally, nationally, and locally for our field conservation work. Here in Minnesota, a lot of work has been done on butterflies, pollinators, bison, turtles, mussels, a lot of great partnerships here in the state, a lot of great work that's been completed. We are the state's largest environmental educator. We do over 400,000 environmental programs. We reach over 400,000 participants in our educational programs, bird shows, close encounters, our camp programs, which are hugely popular in Minnesota. On the school front, we had over 90,000 participants in our school programs this year, from over 1,000 schools throughout Minnesota. And then a little bit on, you know, the size and scale of this zoo. We reach over 1.3 million visitors a year. More people are coming to this Minnesota Zoo than ever before. We have a huge campus, 485-acre campus. We're the fifth largest zoo in the country, so we are a large zoo. 121 buildings, 25 miles of fence, and 10 miles of roads and pathways. We have 276 full-time employees, and these employees include plumbers, electricians, exhibit designers, naturalists, guest service, and, of course, our zookeeper staff. We're open 363 days a year, and one thing that a lot of people don't realize at the Minnesota Zoo is we have over 1,200 volunteers at the Minnesota Zoo, probably the highest volunteer corps, or one of the biggest and best volunteer corps in the country. We just won a national award for reaching over 3 million hours of volunteers. So Minnesotans love to volunteer at the Minnesota Zoo, and we're lucky to have them. To go over our governor's budget recommendation for the zoo, I'm going to turn it over to our chief financial officer. She'll introduce herself. And then I'll come back with some more comments.
Ms. Mosher.
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Abigail Mosher. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at the Minnesota Zoo. So before I dive into the governor's recommendations for the zoo, just wanted to cover quickly. I think the director had covered this with you a few weeks ago, so I'll go quickly. Just looking at our operating revenue, just a reminder that earned income and contributions make up close to 60% of our revenue, and state appropriations are also a very significant part of our business model. Also looking at operating expenses, like other state agencies, salaries and benefits are our single largest line item, and we also have significant costs for utilities, purchase services, and supplies, which actually leads right into our first request. The governor does recommend an operating adjustment for the Minnesota Zoo. State appropriations are a key part of that sustainable business model, as I said, and so those appropriations will need to rise to keep pace with those changes in costs. This request does actually just reflect the state portion. We would also work to grow earned and contributed income to make up the difference. Beyond our usual cost increases for salaries, benefits, utilities, and what have you, we also included this year two items that are unique to this biennium, and it includes the full cost of those items. The first is being consolidated into the minute services enterprise rates for the desktop support model, so that is part of the change, and also higher statewide indirect costs that we'll experience over the next biennium related to the chargeback of routine audit costs from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Our next item is a one-time investment for communication and security systems. Because of our rising staff costs and our significant physical infrastructure needs that the director spoke of, we haven't been able to modernize some of these critical systems, and we really need to as a major cultural institution in Minnesota. So as a major public venue, we do need to be able to respond quickly if an incident were to occur, and these systems are critical to that. Our phone system is 20 years old. It's no longer supported by the manufacturer. The wiring, actually, that it operates on is 40 years old. It's original to the zoo in most cases. And the phones actually lack basic office functions like caller ID, directory of the phone numbers, things like that. So in order to respond to our guests and the public, we do need a modern system. Also, another key way we communicate on the zoo campus is with our digital radio system. Many of our staff are not at office desks during the day. They're out caring for animals. They are responding to guest needs. So we use our two-way radio system as a regular course of business throughout the day. We do face the same mandate others do to become compliant with the federal mandate for digital capability. While about half our radios are digital compliant, our actual underlying system is not. So we need a significant investment to get the rest of the way there. And finally, security cameras. We do have a security camera system that we rely on heavily. With 1.3 million visitors per year as a major public venue, we need to expand that and modernize it. We need higher resolution, and we need to cover some additional areas where we have less coverage today. Our last item is guest mobility. The Minnesota Zoo is striving to eliminate barriers for all Minnesotans, as the director said. We want them to be able to explore and enjoy the Minnesota Zoo. However, before it closed in September 2013, we did have the monorail, which offered a narrated experience that offered some unique animal views. A walk, just to give you an idea, from our guest services area out to the farm is over a mile. And then the Northern Trail by itself is nearly 1 mile. These are large areas for folks to cover if they have limited mobility or if they have toddlers or others who don't travel very quickly. We would like to be able to offer other mobility options. With an aging population and that commitment to access that we have, it's really an imperative. So what we would like to do is build a fleet of vehicles to offer different mobility options. We're currently in a year-long planning process for the master plan for the zoo, and one portion of that is looking at what those mobility options would be and how we would operate them. But what we've been discussing is how to get people from point A to point B using people movers, so carts or other kinds of people movers that we could move them around with. Another is narrated tours. We could leverage trolleys or other types of vehicles for that. And finally, in order to try to connect better to transit hubs like the Mall of America, which is only 6 miles away, looking at having street legal trolleys where we could use that for certain access programming. And while we don't have a page on it because it's not in this committee's jurisdiction, we do have a renewed request for arts and cultural heritage funding, which has also been very important part of supporting zoo programming.
Okay, Mr. Chair, committee members, I just have some closing remarks, and then we can take some questions if you haven't at that time. The zoo is a great state investment. The state dollars invested in Minnesota Zoo have a high economic impact. It's estimated at $228 million of gross economic impact that the zoo brings to the state. So a great return on investment. I've chosen this photo to share with you. If you weren't able to get out to the Minnesota Zoo this October, we hosted a large event. You know, we do rely on the state. It's critical funding that we get from the state budget process. But we always talked about our earned revenue, that we're working hard to bring in our own earned revenue as well. A couple examples are we have a big event called Adult Night Out for millennials and young people, just for the zoo. It's been huge. We averaged between 2,000, and we had one night where over 6,000 Minnesotans came out to the zoo and to enjoy our Adult Night Out. Our October event that we just launched for the first time was Jack-O-Lantern Spectacular. We brought in a huge jack-o'-lantern display of a professionally carved jack-o'-lanterns for the month of October. This exhibit alone brought in 82,000 Minnesotans in the month of October. The great statistic from this event is 75% of the people that came of those 82,000 were not zoo members. You know, so this is, you know, our role is to provide great, safe family outings for Minnesotans, and they're showing up. And it's an earned revenue project for us. So, you know, I guess the takeaway that we're asking committee members to know is when you hear or talk about the Minnesota Zoo, we just want you to know that there is a smart plan. It's a conservative but a smart plan, and more people now than ever are enjoying the benefits of the Minnesota Zoo. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Frawley. Were those Minnesota-grown pumpkins? Or?
I believe they were, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Representative Wagenius and then Representative Green.
I'm sorry I wasn't in here earlier. Tell me about your efforts on renewable energy and climate change.
Mr. Frawley.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we, although we're a small state agency, we have started to align with the administration's goals for sustainability on our campus. We are, like we've outlined, we are a large campus. So we have a group of zoo employees that are focused on a sustainable business model. So we've looked at our energy, our waste, our use of plastics, and we're starting to incorporate all those goals and set our own goals on sustainability. It's early on, So we have a lot of work ahead of us, but we realize we have to be a model. We embarked this year on bioretention ponds throughout the zoo and installed 8 of them, working with soil and water conservation groups so that we can show the public how they can work in their own land and their own homes on stopping runoff. We are working right now on a stormwater retention plan for the top of the tropics building, our main largest roof that we have, recapturing that water and reclaiming that water. So I wish I had a better, more thorough report. I think it's something that I'm very interested in, developing a smart plan on that front as well. But those are some of the examples that we've embarked on already.
Representative Wagenius.
If I could follow up, I specifically asked about renewable energy and what your plan would be there.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Frolic, you have committee members. Wonderful opportunity for solar since you have so much acreage.
So we have worked with Dakota County, and we've actually done some modeling of solar panels throughout our tropics building, but also most recently we had a study done on our parking lots to bring solar throughout the entire parking lot. I don't know the final results of where that landed. I think the economic model wasn't quite where we were hoped that it would be. But we are exploring it, and we have engaged on the solar front, on a couple fronts, also working with the state as well, some of the efforts the state has put forward on that. So I'm not briefed enough to speak thoroughly on it today, but we have done some initial studies on solar.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, we're all working toward a 2030 goal, mm-hmm. when we have to do a lot better mm-hmm. by 2030. So I hope that is your end game, not something beyond.
Mr. Frolic.
Mr. Chair, new members, we will get back to you and formalize that our process and plans. I agree. I think the zoo has a chance to be a model for Minnesotans and is a very highly visible area for sustainable practices. So I look forward to that.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. One is just for my own curiosity. Back on, I don't have a number on it, but the one slide that says operating on the scale of a small city. Mm-hmm. What is that?
Mr. Frolic.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I think, you know, I think we'd like to point out the size and scale of this zoo. The average zoo in our country is less than 50 acres. You know, most zoos are closer to 15, 20 acres, even the zoos here in Minnesota, the other two zoos in Minnesota here. So our zoo, as it relates to zoos, we are a large campus with lots of roads, lots of buildings, lots of infrastructure, and I think we're just trying to get the point across. The other thing about a zoo is it's almost like running a hospital. It's 24/7, 365 days a year. We have to, you know, keep it this large facility operating. And so I think we were just trying to point out the scale of this zoo. I think a lot of people don't realize how big the Minnesota Zoo is.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I should have phrased my question better. On your slide, what is that?
Oh, what is that? Mr. Chair, committee members. That is the roof of our tropics building. And those are our tropics building, and 40 years ago when the tropics building was built, it was one of the largest indoor tropics exhibits in the country, with a glass roof. And I think that's a photo from above, from I believe a drone photo that we recently had flying over the zoo. So those are the roofs of our main tropics.
Okay, so those are not the solar panels that you talked about that didn't really work out for you.
Mr. Chairman, and members, no. Those are skylights, I guess is the right word for those.
Okay. Now, Mr. Chair, I'll go to the real questions. you know, you've got, it looks like you're going to have two 34-passenger trolleys, and I assume that they're year-round because you're going to do year-round. Do you have a place to house them? I mean, is that included in this? Because they're pretty big. And then it looks like you also want a 10-passenger van and a 14-passenger van. So you got a lot, or two 10-passenger carts. You got a lot of stuff there. I mean, do you have garages for them, or?
Yep.
Mr. Frolic.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, when the monorail closed, the monorail was a large, obviously large operating, had a large operating system, and there was a monorail barn, a heated, full-functioning monorail barn. All the monorails were put away at night, and there was two working monorails with different cars. So we have a large, heated barn or storage shed for all, for vehicles that would be suitable for these five vehicles that we're requesting. So we have an infrastructure to support them. We're not going to have to build barns or have any additional support. We have the infrastructure at the zoo site to house these vehicles.
Okay, then just one last question, Mr. Chair, if I could. You've got, you're going to be bringing these out onto the freeways and stuff. Within your budget ask, I assume then that you've got money budgeted in for maybe some increased liability for these things on the road?
Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Mr. Chair, members, this includes the one-time cost for the investment in the vehicles. It does not include the operating costs. As I mentioned earlier, we're in the midst of the planning effort associated with this as part of our broader master plan. And so as part of that, we'll develop a pro forma for this effort like we do for others, and then we would work out the financial model that's associated with it. And we do purchase liability insurance from the Department of Administration Risk Management, and so we'd work with them to identify the appropriate amount.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions? Anybody in the audience that wants to testify? Thank you, Mr. Frawley.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Metropolitan Council.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm going to pull up my presentation here.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Lisa Beth Barajas. I'm the Community Development Director at the Metropolitan Council. Today I'm going to talk to you about the regional park system and the operation and maintenance budget. So certainly not the full council budget and certainly not the full amount that is appropriated to the council from the state, but just the operations and maintenance funding portion. As a reminder, just a couple of weeks ago, I had the pleasure of presenting in front of you just what we do in regional parks at the Metropolitan Council. So I just wanted to give just a little refresh. This map in front of you is a map of the regional system, the 7-county area. The shaded areas represent the 10 implementing agencies in their jurisdictions. So those implementing agencies in the region actually own and operate the regional park system. You can see the series of parks and trails that are open today within this that are part of the regional system. We have over 54,000 acres of parkland in the regional system, nearly 400 miles of regional trails, and over 58 million visits in 2017. And as you recall from my last presentation a couple of weeks ago, that's a growing amount of visitation, and we've seen that continue to grow over the life of our park system. Our regional plan is to expand to include over 70,000 acres of parkland and 1,100 miles of regional trails that would connect residents to the parks and connecting the parks to one another, so really completing that full system. The council administers regional parks grant programs that provide funds for both the operations and maintenance, as well as the acquisition and development of the regional system. As you can see on this graphic, which also should be familiar to you, all four of our grant programs are sourced through state funds, several of which are distributed by formula that is outlined in statute. You can also see that the council provides regional bonds matching 3 out of 4 of these grant programs. Today, we're going to focus on the operation and maintenance portion of our overall grant program. This is the one area that the council does not match. Our bonds go for capital, operations, and maintenance are to maintain and operate the system. Rather, the state provides an amount through the budget, which the council then distributes to each of the 10 parks implementing agency, also through a formula that is set in statute. This amount is a combination of both general fund dollars and lottery and lieu dollars. The governor released his proposed budget earlier this week, and his recommendation is to support continuing the $8.4 million annual O&M funding for this biennium for the regional park system. That total is split between $2.54 million in general fund dollars each year and $6 million in lottery in lieu dollars each year. So this, like I said, continues the state appropriations, which you can see as a blue line across the bottom of this chart. State appropriations have been really steady over the last 30 years of this program, but really haven't kept up with the cost of actually operating and maintaining our regional system. As I've talked about before, our system has grown, and we continue to plan to grow our system because our region is growing. We're projecting to add 800,000 residents to our region between 2010 and 2040, and the growing regional system will keep up with the recreational needs of our growing population. The gray line on this chart reflects the goal that's described in statute around the state providing 40% of the O&M expenses. So that means this difference between the state appropriations and the actual O&M expenses are picked up by our local parks implementing agencies, and that share has increased over time. And just a reminder, as I've noted a couple of weeks ago and earlier in my presentation, our parks visitation has had over 58 million visits in 2017, and that was up from 33 million visits in 2005. So we're seeing our parks are very well loved, which means our maintenance needs also are growing to go along with that. So what exactly does this funding pay for? Our implementing agencies include plans for how they manage the park system as part of their master planning process. And it includes everything from staffing costs to put on programming, engaging with the public around meeting their needs locally, what sorts of activities they'd like to provide within each of those regional parks. And then just general maintenance that's shown in some of the images on the slide. That includes vehicle and trail maintenance, snow plowing and trail grooming, as shown in the image on the upper left, habitat restoration, tree trimming, and other similar activities as shown in the image on the lower right. So the regional system provides both recreational activities but also natural resource and habitat protection for especially the larger portions, the regional park reserves. So really maintaining the natural resource pieces that folks are coming to experience are a large portion of those costs. That state contribution to the regional parks O&M costs help offset local expenditures for really the exchange of providing that regional benefit. As I discussed earlier a couple of weeks ago, a fair amount of visitation to our regional parks are not just from the local residents who live near to those parks, but also are to other regional residents and residents from other portions of the state as well. So really helping to offset the cost of providing a regional system or providing recreation opportunities for folks from around the region and around the state. Just a short presentation for you today, but I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So back to the previous slide. In the top left corner, I've got my fingers crossed. Is that a groomed snowmobile trail?
Ms. Barajas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I had a sense that you might have asked that question. You know, I couldn't say for sure. I imagine it's both. This is from, I believe, Anoka County. And in some of our regional parks, there are opportunities for snowmobile trails, but a lot of cross-country skiing happens in our parks as well.
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, I continue to keep my fingers crossed.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had said that you've got 54.5 actually 1,000 acres now of parks, is that correct? And you want to expand that to 70,000, so you're adding about 16,000 acres. Is this, do you have the land picked out? Is it residential now, or is it state land now?
Ms. Brass.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, as part of our regional parks planning process, with our 10 implementing agencies, together we identify where those last best lands remained within the region. These are primarily natural resource lands. By statute, our regional park system is a natural resources-based system. So some of those, there's two components to that remaining portion. There are search areas for, I believe, three new units in the regional park system that are located in what are primarily undeveloped lands right now that have high-quality natural resources. And it also includes acquisition that hasn't fully occurred yet for existing regional parks or planned regional parks that have not yet been fully acquired. So some of those include lands that are undeveloped. Some are maybe perhaps some have some residential use on them today, and it might be in holdings within existing regional parks, and some of them might be in agricultural practice today. So that's a combination of lands, not all residential and not all natural resource. So some of them fill out existing regional parks, and some of them are new parks as part of the system.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, I'm going to ask two questions, and then I'm going to be done so that I don't belabor this too much. But the first question is, you know, in greater Minnesota, we lose about 10,000 to 12,000 acres a year through the Lessard-Sams Council's recommendations. First of all, have you ever applied for some of those monies through Lessard-Sams? And second, the land that you have that you said is already natural resource land, at what cost would that come to the park systems? And if you're already on the border of not being able to care for what you've got, what do you have and what is your intention to moving forward to manage the park systems as they expand?
Ms. Brass.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, on your first question on Lessard-Sams, I'd have to ask my staff. I know in the past the council has accessed those dollars, but if I could invite our parks manager down to speak to that question, I think he'd give you a fuller answer on that. It has been some time in my memory that I didn't think of that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emmett Mullen, and I'm the parks manager at the Metropolitan Council with the Regional Park System.
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you. Representative Green, Mr. Chair, a number of our park agencies have been successful in receiving Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council funding to do natural resource management work and other conservation work. I don't know that they've received any money to do acquisition, though. I can get the answer to that question and get back to you.
Your second, Mr. Chair, Representative, your second question was, what was the plan for maintaining the system if we're kind of pushing up against ability today? Part of expanding our system is, like I had mentioned before, is adding land that's already adjacent to or with already located within the system. And I think our master plans for those parks cover what those costs actually do. I know that they already cover those costs and include plans for those costs as part of their master planning process today. The additional three parks have three new units haven't undergone a full detailed master planning process yet. They're still in the searching phase. So it would really depend on the state of the lands when we acquire of them, how much restoration would need to be done, and certainly a lot more detail would need to go into what that might cost and then what ongoing operations and maintenance might look like depending on what types of activities want to be provided in each of those new units. So I can't give you a really solid answer on that, but certainly it is a consideration I know our implementing agencies have top of mind on a regular basis.
Mr. Chair, then the final part of the question, I know I threw them at you kind of fast, was if you've got land there that you said is now natural resource land. Now, should the park system acquire that, what is the cost of that? Is it?
Ms. Brass.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I don't recall off the top of my head. We did do a costing exercise as part of our last regional plan update. I'd have to look at the details, but I can follow up with you specifically on what we had estimated the cost of acquisition would be for those new units.
One last thing, then, just a comment.
One last thing.
If you have natural resource land there right now that belongs to the state, and the parks are an asset to the state, the cost at most should be minimal, because you guys are going to be taking over the management of that land, and it still belongs to the state. So if you need any help on that, let me know. I'll help you out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, actually, I don't believe any of that land belongs to the state. I think that's all in private ownership at this time. But thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We all need to be role models as we move toward the 2030 challenge for reducing climate change gases. Talk to us about two things, your use of renewable energy, and do you have electric vehicle charging stations at all of, well, tell us about how many you have and where they are.
Sure. It's Brass, Madam Chair. Representative Wagenius, the council has a broad approach for how we own and what our role is in climate change as an organization. And I want to separate that from what our regional parks agencies do. They're separate agencies and have their own plans for addressing climate change within their agencies. So we have, as part of our agencies, we have everywhere from cities like Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as counties like Dakota and Scott and Washington County, Anoka County, and then also Three Rivers Park District. I'm probably missing some folks in there, but suffice it to say that each of those governmental agencies have their own plans for addressing climate change. The council has a broader approach to climate change because we have a broader portfolio that's more than just the regional park system, and I'd be happy to share more with you on that as well. That's everything from electrification of our transit fleet to our own non-revenue rolling stock, the planning efforts that we're doing to support and assess climate vulnerability in regional systems, as well as providing local government data and support and helping them to consider what climate change impacts will have to infrastructure within their community. So we have everything from the planning piece all the way to the operational pieces. Relating to EV charging stations, I don't believe we have any yet online today, but it is part of our electrification plan for the C line. I'm talking a little bit out of my area of expertise, but our Metro Transit is working on making the C line, which runs through North Minneapolis, electric BRT system there, and finding places to put in EV charging stations as part of that system.
Representative Regine.
Thank you. It's hard for me to understand from what you have said what your intended outcomes are. I hear something about talking and planning and input. So if you could get back to us about what your outcomes will be between now and 2030 and your benchmarks for getting there, that would be helpful, because we are the role models. And when we spend public money, we have to be thinking about that role.
Director Brass?
Yes, thank you. And Representative Wagenius, to follow up, I will say that as part of Thrive MSP 2040, we are committed to meeting the state's adopted standards for that are set out in the Renewable Energy Next Generation Energy Act. I'm going to make sure I got that right. And doing that in both our planning and operations. But I'm happy to follow up with you with some additional targets that we've set in the different portions of our agency.
If there are no questions or testimony from the audience, we'll move on to House File 850. Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, we have House File 850 up for consideration today. It was referred to the division by the Ways and Means Committee. Chair Hansen, do you move that House File 850 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 850. This is a chronic waste and disease appropriation. The bill, as it was introduced, was the recommendation from former Governor Dayton's budget. I anticipated there would be a budget recommendation from Governor Walz. I didn't know what it would be, so I wanted to get this in as a placeholder based on what the needs were last year. And I do have an author's amendment. I believe it is the A2 amendment, which does put in the governor's recommendation for the Commissioner of Natural Resources for responding to chronic waste and disease. And if I could move the A2 amendment to get it to the House File 850 to get the bill in the shape I would like.
Chair Hansen moves the A2 amendment. Representative Hansen, please speak to your amendment.
And I have Mr. Leach here to speak about the governor's budget recommendation.
Before we take testimony, we need to vote on the amendment. Chair Hansen has moved the A2 amendment. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Now you may present your bill.
Thank you. Mr. Leach.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Leach. I'm the director for the Division of Fish and Wildlife with Minnesota DNR. We are very supportive of this budget request from the governor. I can break it down into the various components of how it's proposed to be spent. Surveillance and response in Deer Permit Area 603, our southeast focus area, core area for CWD, will focus primarily in Fillmore, Houston, and Winona counties. That will be, again, surveillance and response in that area. For new Deer Permit Area 604, which is Crow Wing County.
A little clearer. We're having trouble hearing you, so I'll speak right into the mic. Eat the mic.
Is that better?
There you go.
Sorry about that. My apologies. I'm breaking down the governor's budget request and the request that's in Representative Hansen's bill. First, surveillance in 603, Fillmore, Winona, and Houston counties, $1 million each year for FY 20 and 21. That's for surveillance and response in that core area. With the new Deer Permit Area 604 in Crow Wing County, again, surveillance and response, we would propose to spend $436,000 each of the two fiscal years for surveillance and response in that new Deer Permit Area. Also part of this is for two new enforcement officers, our law enforcement officers, to assist with CWD enforcement and regulation surveillance on existing cervid farms across the state. It's also calling for one new position for 2 years, again, to enhance our landowner outreach with private landowners in CWD areas. There is lots of interest and lots of education that needs to be done with private landowners about the disease, its spread, transmission to humans, and outreach to them is very critical. We've also noticed in the southeast that landowner outreach is extremely important to get on key properties for access to deer, and that's what that position would be really focused on. Again, $300,000 in fiscal year 20 and $200,000 in 21 for USDA culling efforts in the southeast, similar to what's ongoing right today in the southeast. And with the new find of CWD in Crow Wing County, we would propose funding for culling of the deer herd in Crow Wing around that positive deer farm and where the new find was. That would be $250,000 just in FY20. In total, it would be $4.57 million as a budget request for Representative Hansen's bill and what's in the governor's proposed budget. With that, I would open it up to questions.
And I believe Mr. Cornicelli is here, too, to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess one of the questions I would have is, do we have a feel whether the USDA Wildlife Services folks from APHIS, if they've got enough capacity here to stretch without, because that's a
very unique group of people, and I like to use the word taking additional samples instead of culling. Unfortunately, we do have to, you know, eliminate the deer to take the sample. But that's a very specialized group of people with extremely rare and specialized skills. So I don't know if any discussions as to can they bring enough people to bear at the same time to get the job done.
Director Leach.
Madam Chair, members, there has been discussions, ongoing discussions with USDA. They have the capacity to have a team in Crow Wing County yet this year and to continue our efforts in the southeast. Mr. Cornicelli will correct me if I'm wrong on any of this.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's a concern because there's not a lot of those folks out there with that skill set.
Are there other questions from the committee? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions. You, Mr. Leach, Director Leach, you testified on the amount that you're requesting. How do you arrive at those numbers?
Director Leach.
Madam Chair and members, it's really based on past surveillance efforts. We know what we've spent on surveillance efforts in the southeast since we've been doing it for a number of years. So it's based on experience of what we anticipate our needs are in future years and our CWD response plan. If a new find of CWD is found in some part of the state, our response plan directs us to what we're going to do from a response. And we know what those costs are, so it's based on past experience and what we anticipate and see on the horizon.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then there's been some concern expressed, I believe, by DNR and some of our committee members about earlier CWD efforts that since 2004, I believe, resulted in about $7.5 million being used out of the Game and Fish Fund. This is quite a chunk. Can you clarify for me DNR's maybe position in the past compared to what you seem to be doing here in this bill amendment?
Director Leach.
Madam Chair and members, again, the number Representative Fabian that you used, I'm not sure where that $7 million came from. If it was a DNR number, it came out of our shop, and Dr. Cornicelli will know that number more specifically than I. But what we're seeing now is with new cervid farms being identified as positive, it expands our need for our response plan. And each time that a new cervid farm is identified, it really requires DNR per our surveillance plan to increase surveillance for 3 years until we don't find a positive new deer in that geographic area. So the culmination of what we're doing in the southeast with the new find in Winona County, with the new find in Crow Wing County, these are additive costs. So if we were just to maintain our focus in the southeast, it would cost less than expanding our focus to Winona County, Meeker County, where we have a positive farm, and now Crow Wing County, where we have a third positive farm, where we're required to do surveillance for 3 years.
Representative.
Thank you. And I support that. But my point is that, and maybe Mr. Cornicelli can testify, I believe it was Commissioner Meyer that some people conveyed the message that they didn't like the fact, and I think maybe Representative Becker Finn, Representative Hansen, Chair Hansen, didn't like the fact that $7.5 million was coming from the Game and Fish Fund to combat the CWD, and there were some inferences made that somebody else should be doing this. Me, full disclosure, I've said from day one as a deer hunter who belongs to the Deer Hunters Association, who bought 3 deer tags last year, didn't tag a deer, but that's the price you pay. I'm okay with this. So I guess what I'm asking of the rest of the committee members is, are you okay now spending $900,000 out of the Game and Fish Fund and the DNR itself?
Director Leach? Or was that a question to all the other committee members?
It's somewhat of a rhetorical question, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and Representative Fabian, I think it wasn't right to be only funding these things out of the Game and Fish Fund. And so you look at both my original bill and the as it's amended, and I believe the governor has said we need to have a general fund response. If you look at the Section B, what that is funding, that is looking at more the things that I think are appropriate for the Game and Fish Fund, with assessing seasonal fawn survival and seasonal deer movement, obtain improved deer location data and dispersal patterns. So we're getting more science out of that that applies not just to the response, but overall. And I think you've seen the DNR webpage where they're tracking as the deer are moving. I mean, I think that has helped inform the response, but also how we manage deer in general. So I think this is an appropriate recommendation. In addition, I did not include the components that are for the Board of Animal Health. I put them so that's in a different lane. So that's. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, but just for the committee's knowledge, I believe that since 2004, there's been about $1.7 billion that have gone through the Game and Fish Fund. So the $750 million that people were having some heartburn over is really actually a very, very small fraction of the Game and Fish Fund. And again, as a legislator, as a deer hunter, I'm okay with that. I think that we need to spend the money as needed, and I support what you're doing. I think my numbers are right. Is that right, Mr. Hagemeyer?
Mr. Hagemeyer?
Or did I get a B wrong and an M?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, I think you're correct in there. You might have said $750 million for the deer research, which I'm sure they would love to have that amount. But
$7.5 million, I'm sorry.
I believe the 17-year period you had me look up was roughly $1.6 billion total for all the accounts in the Game and Fish Fund for revenues. The expenditures, as you mentioned, were $7.5 million that the DNR provided.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And had a couple other questions before we took this turn, but I think in response to that, I think the heartburn was not so much that the DNR is doing what they need to do to take care of this, but that the deer hunters are paying for something that is not exacerbated by their actions and their behaviors. I think that's the troubling piece. It's not the number overall. It's that, you know, when you look at the maps and you look at what we know that there's a connection with deer farms and with that industry. And, you know, they're not paying for those costs, even though, you know, the positives found in their areas are directly related to the surveillance efforts that are then necessary for the wild deer herd. So I think, like, let's be clear, that's what the concern is over. It's not about using Game and Fish dollars for deer-related activities. It's because who should be paying, and is it fair that deer hunters are the ones paying for that? And so I think that's so that actually is related to my first question. So the amounts requested for surveillance by the DNR, do those amounts cover the full amount of the work you're doing, or is any other piece helping to support those efforts?
Director Leach or Dr. Cornelius?
I would call on Dr. Cornicelli to answer that. I believe the answer is yes, but I would rather have Dr. Cornicelli respond accordingly.
Madam Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, we think so. I mean, for the record, I should know better. For the record, Lou Cornicelli, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. As best we can tell, yes. You know, we're certainly thankful for any bit of general fund we get to do this work. As I've talked about, it's kind of a societal broad issue. Certainly there's other work we're looking at doing, engaging in our deer hunters and general public on disease in general, some of the hunter losses we've seen maybe related to disease. So I think there's other work we'd like to do. However, I think this identifies what we, you know, would plan to do given the uncertainty of what we might find next week or the next 2 weeks.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So again, you know, 100% of the costs, it sounds like, of this additional surveillance is being done on the wildlife side, even though there are direct connections to, you know, other areas of the law and other funds. And so, again, related to that, so I'm glad to see that that part of the plan is to add additional conservation officers and the landowner outreach piece, because I don't think people kind of realize that that was a really unique thing that you guys have started to do, that it's really, I think, helpful, you know, and especially now that that piece of outreach to your average Minnesotan and your average deer hunter is now going to have to include folks in the northern part of the state as well now with the positive in Crow Wing County. So I was really glad that that was included, because I think that's important, that we're really connecting with deer hunters and your average deer hunter who is having to change the way they do things because of this. And then my last question is, wondering if this includes or if part of the plan involves any tribal outreach, because you know, a piece of this that we maybe haven't fully discussed in these committees yet is that there are some treaty implications and some implications as we talk about meaningful consultation with the tribes. I think too, this positive in Crow Wing County is now, you know, all of these positives have ramifications for all of our constitutional right to hunt, but is also getting awfully close to that treaty territory, and that's really concerning. And so I'm just wondering what kind of outreach we're doing to, share these positive results, share recommendations with our tribal communities.
Dr. Cornicelli.
Madam Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, that's an excellent point, and we've done that. You're right. I think the north end of the area touches 1855. And when we put the call out of notifying affected folks, legislators, county officials, tribal representatives were included in that notification. So they were called individually by one of our staff members. And our plan is to, as we go, you were perfectly correct, this engagement piece and outreach and working with landowners. But that work involves not only hunters and landowners, but the general public as well, and all those who are affected, and the tribal folks, especially in this area, because it does touch the treaty areas. Is that's top of mind for us.
Thank you.
Are there other questions for Representative Heintzman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad that the doctor's here today, and I would also like to thank Representative Heintzman for bringing this bill forward. I think there's a lot of positive elements here, and I'm hoping.
Hanson. You said Heintzman yourself.
You think.
That doesn't normally happen, but a glitch, I apologize. No, it must be the beard Representative Lewick says. It could be.
Could be.
Thank you, Representative Hanson, for bringing this issue forward. I do have a question piggybacking on what Representative Becker-Finn was mentioning, and this is a question that's coming to me, not Representative Hanson in Crow Wing County. A lot of residents are of course, noticing the proximity of the animal that was found in Crow Wing County to the Cervidae. And in the day and age of some incredible science and genetic information that can link an animal or a person to a specific area, where is the science at this point? I mean, are we to the point now where we can say we know that this animal was infected by an animal in this location, or are there other environmental factors that we're still considering?
Dr. Cornicelli?
Madam Chair, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you.
The science isn't there yet. There's been some work on Western blot testing related to strain typing of chronic wasting disease prions, but it's not there yet. It's not like, as Representative Lewick would know, that you can strain type bovine TB down to the state it came from. We can't do that yet with the chronic wasting disease prion. So that science is constantly evolving, and we may get there someday. Like I said, there's been a little bit of work done on elk, but it's been pretty thin, and it's not really conclusive. We're just not there yet with respect to, this is the Indiana strain of this disease or somewhere else.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, okay, so to follow up, I appreciate that answer. Do we as legislators or other folks that people are looking to for information, do we need to be cautious when we suggest that there's a direct connection or to a deer farm, a cervid farm specifically, or is there other ways that we're making that leap, determining that? Now, considering that this animal that was found in my county is less than a half mile away from a farm, I think that's a reasonable thing for people to assume. But based on what you just said, that may not be the direction that as leaders on this particular issue that we should be making a statement that we know or we are certain that CWD positive animal is directly connected to the cervid farm.
Dr. Gorenstein.
Madam Chair, Representative Heintzman, that's why you see likely in what we've been saying. You know, we're looking at our past surveillance data in the area, which is extensive, I think almost 9,000 deer sampled. We look at the infection on that facility, which has now really been occurring since 2016 up through 2018, and then the proximity of a clinically found dead deer out so close to the facility. So it doesn't, for our measure of likely, it's not necessarily the ability to strain type. It's more associated with the data that we've collected and the inferences we can make based on the information we have. So I think likely is the term we've been using, and I think that's the appropriate term. We haven't said definitely or conclusively. We've said likely. So that's kind of where we're going with that.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A little, quite a bit different subject, but and I just asked this question on a broader front because we know that there's some connection, potential connection with moose and chronic wasting disease, and are we just kind of looking at that, or obviously you got your hands full, more than your hands full right now, but we've had this long-standing issue with the moose population, and part of that has to do with the lot more white-tailed deer in the areas where there's moose. So, and again, just are we at least sensitive to that? There's a possibility there that could be a problem for moose also.
Dr. Bernicelli?
Madam Chair, Representative Lewick, yes, moose are susceptible to chronic wasting disease just like all cervids are. As part of our, when we had a moose season, as part of our adult moose mortality study, CWD was in the panel of tests that we did. So all the moose that have either been killed by hunters since mid-2000s plus everything in the mortality study has been tested where we can, and we've had all not detected results. The moose issue is certainly related to a whole host of factors, winter ticks, liver flukes, brainworm, all sorts of stuff. But we've not implicated CWD because we haven't found it in the arrowhead, either in deer or in moose.
Thank you. Manager, that's at least that's one thing that's not on the list that we're wrestling with over moose.
I'm sure I believe there's an amendment, and I know that Representative Davids is getting nervous.
Yes. Yes, Representative Becker Finn, I believe you have the A3 amendment. Would you like to move the amendment?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Becker Finn moves the A3 amendment. Please speak to your amendment.
Yep. Members, the A3 amendment, with the blessing of the author of the bill, the A3 amendment is the funding that was discussed in this committee. Request from the U of M to put together a CWD supergroup and develop a diagnostic test for chronic wasting disease, so that we could test sooner and have results possibly in live animals. And this would also include that we take into account environmental health and human health potential impacts as well. So this actually matches the standalone bill that I brought forward, and would ask for your support.
Representative Beckerfin moves the A3 amendment. Is there any further discussion? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I support the concept here. I think we should need to have a discussion somewhere through this process about using LCCMR as a source of funding for this. I think it would fit really quite well. But that's for another day.
Thank you. Is there any other discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? And Representative Beckerfin?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for your support of the amendment. I did one more quick question for Dr. Cornicelli, wherever he ran off to. Maybe someone else knows the answer to this. I know that I'd been listening to KFAN Outdoors over the weekend, and I just wanted to clarify in how many feet away the positive CWD deer was found from the fence of the captive facility where they've had positives.
Dr. Cornicelli?
Madam Chair, Representative Beckerfin, I apologize. I didn't mean to get up so quickly. About a half mile, between four-tenths and a half, so 2,600 feet, give or take.
Representative Beckerfin?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just, wanted to point out that I think likely could mean a lot of things, but I think the potential of that being from some other location, the most likely source is probably the positive that was 2,600 feet away. So thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Just real quickly to testifiers, recently I came upon an article and it referenced Dr. Frank Bostain from Louisiana State University, who's working on a test and so forth. Are you familiar with that work, and what's your impression of that? I believe that all science needs to be brought in here. Help me out, Dr. Cornicelli.
Dr. Cornicelli.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, yes, I'm aware of that. It's been getting a lot of, I can't tell you how many times that's been forwarded to me over the last week. The person in question is a medical doctor at Louisiana State University, published a study some time ago theorizing that it wasn't actually a prion, it was a bacteria instead, and that study has yet to be replicated. So I believe, I can't recall the individual's name, from the University of Minnesota, did a really nice job at his testimony talking about looking at the stars from the Earth and pretending it's the Hubble telescope. I like that analogy. I think until that science can be replicated, it's hard to put a lot of power into. The foremost experts on these diseases firmly believe, both from human health and CJD and bovines and sheep and deer, that this is a prion disease. It's not a spirochete. So until that work can be replicated in the lab or somewhere else, it doesn't seem plausible at this time.
Thank you. We do have another testifier.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Lance Ness. I'm the president of the Minnesota Conservation Federation. I'm president of the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance. I'll be brief because I know you have more business to do here. I do have a copy we're handing out with our letterhead on it. And again, I'll be brief. This is not a deer hunting issue. I'll repeat that. This is not a deer hunting issue. This is a public health issue. I've listened, as all of you have, to the testimony of the U of M veterinary school professors, and they recommended that no one should eat venison that's contaminated by CWD. We're very concerned that the actions taken so far by the state in response to these outbreaks. In the past, we have outbreaks of other diseases, such as bovine tuberculosis and avian flu in turkeys. We have acted immediately to cull those herds and prevent further spread of the disease. But we seem to have dragged our feet a little on this issue. How long before the first butcher shop reports that they are contaminated by processing a deer that carries CWD? And we have no choice but to close and shut down that business. We are concerned not only about the tradition of harvesting venison since this country was founded, but will be lost and the ramifications that will result in the millions, millions of dollars. This is not a deer hunting issue. This is a public health issue and an economic issue. Thank you.
Thank you. I will renew Representative Hansen's motion that House File 850 is, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over.
Thank you. Representative David.
Representative David says House File 952. I move that House File 952 be laid over for future consideration. Representative Davids, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. I'll be brief on my part. House File 952 is the Red River State Trail, a Creston to Carmona bill. We have a placeholder of $5 million in the bill. I would like to let the committee, the chairman of the committee, know that I am working with the DNR on this, and we're in discussions as we speak on the numbers, and they have a couple other issues they'd like to look at with me, so we are talking to them. You should each have a packet that very succinctly lays out what we're attempting to do here. This is a shovel-ready product or project, and as it says in the brochure here, this trail will be the most scenic part of the Bluffton's trail system. So with that, I'd like to introduce Mr. Dan Christensen of F&M Bank and the city administrator, Joe Hoffman, if who'd like to start? Okay, start Mr. Hoffman, if we could, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hoffman, yes. Welcome.
Chair Hansen, members of the committee, it's an honor to appear here. My name is Joe Hoffman. I'm the city administrator for the city of Preston. As Representative Davids indicated, we have a brief packet of information here. I'd like to start out with the map page here that gives you a sense regionally where this trail is. As you can see, Lanesboro is in the center of the map. Preston is in the lower left. You can see Carmona, the yellow trail running east-west toward Forestville Mystery Cave State Park, is the trail under consideration here today. The entire trail system is called the Bluffland State Trail system. It includes the Root River and the Harmony Preston Valley State Trails, but I think most people just refer to it as the Root River State Trail. Representative Davids did indicate these two quotes that we have here that I think are very important. The one from Craig Blummer indicating how scenic this section of the trail will be is important. For those of the opinion that this is the most scenic trail in Minnesota, this would be the most scenic section of the most scenic trail. And so we see a lot of value in that. And also, just a comment that this, in fact, is a shovel-ready project and has been for some time. The Forestville Trail effort, or this segment of trail, began in the early 1990s. The options were all completed in 1998, and the land was purchased in 2002 by the DNR. And so the DNR currently owns this property. It's basically a ribbon of land that runs west out of Preston. The DNR's master trail plan for the trail was completed in 2003, and construction on the trail actually began in 2012 and 2013. So this is an active, ongoing project of the DNR. And I want to reiterate that this is not a local trail project. This is very much a DNR project, and it is a legislatively authorized state trail. And the DNR considers it a Tier 1 designation for the trail, the highest designation that they have, and it is classified as a destination trail, as it will connect the Root River State Trail with Forestville Mr. Cave State Park. It's a complicated trail. There's no doubt about that. It's a 10-mile trail in all, and it includes 12 bridges, and that's significant, and we understand that. But it will follow the south branch of the Root River from Preston to Forestville State Park. And the challenges there is, as you get further up the river valley, the valley narrows, and there's just more challenges there. And as I'd indicated, there's quite a few bridges. In fact, 75% of the project cost is associated with bridges. This isn't a prairie trail following fence lines. This is a very scenic but challenging trail to build. It is on the Parks and Trails Council 2018-2019 legislative priority list. And to date, maybe you'd call it the local match, but the city of Preston has invested over $200,000 on the connecting trail, and I'll speak more about that just briefly. Today, what we're actually discussing is just the Preston to Carmona segment. Again, the state of Minnesota currently owns all of the land for the right-of-way of the trail, and the trail and bridge alignments are completed for that section, 6 miles, seven bridges, and a small trailhead at Carmona as well. It won't go all the way to the state park. It gets about 2 to 3 miles from the state park, but from that point, that trailhead into the park, it's a what we would call a leisurely ride on some quiet country roads. And so it gets us very close to the state park. And again, this is an active project. The legislature has already invested over $1 million to date. The trail is about 20% complete with two bridges and about a mile of trail open right now. And again, I think, as you had referenced, the placeholder, the numbers that we have that are from 2013 and adjusted for inflation put the remaining cost of this segment at about $5.3 million. I'll briefly take you through the second map or aerial photo that we have on the far right. What did you call that, fuchsia? I think that's fuchsia. Is that right? Representative of Davis. The small fuchsia trail you see on the far right is the Harmony Preston Valley State Trail on the edge of Preston. That's what connects into the Root River Trail by Lanesboro. The blue segment there is what we'd call the in-town trail, or the trail that the city of Preston acquired and built to connect the Harmony Preston Valley Trail to the Forestville segment. And then the red and yellow dash section is the trail that's already constructed. And so that's two bridges and about a mile of trail or so, about $1 million worth of work. And so the yellow section is the section that's under consideration today, which would be to Carimona with the construction of a trailhead there. And so from the nuts and bolts standpoint, that concludes my testimony. And I believe Mr. Christensen will speak to some of the broader issues related to the trail.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Christensen. I am the CEO of F&M Community Bank, which is based in Preston. I'm a lifelong resident of Preston and an avid trail user. I've been on most of the miles of the trail, and if any of you have been down here, you'll find it's actually a gorgeous place to ride and walk. Cross-country ski this year, you know, we happen to have enough snow for that. As Mr. Hoffman mentioned, this would connect eventually to Forestville State Park. Mark White is the park manager. He is in favor of seeing this trail completed. He sees it as a way to increase usage of the Forestville State Park. And the park is also a great example of the driftless area. If you haven't been to southeast Minnesota, it's very different from the rest of the state. And I have many friends who live in the metro area, and they drive down there, and they can't believe that that's actually part of Minnesota. So if you haven't been down to that part of the state, I'd encourage you to go down there. As far as the impact on the area, you know, this trail system began in the mid-'80s. Initially, there was some reluctance to see that happen. However, tourism, because of the trail, has become a much larger part of the region. And by adding this segment to the trail would not only increase tourism, but would also help diversify the regional economy. As you know, ag economy goes up and down, and right now it's in a downward trend. And this would help diversify the Fillmore County and the southeast Minnesota region. Economically, we need to have something that would provide a little more base to offset those down years. As far as other uses of the trail, this segment of the south branch of the Root River, which originates in the park, is actually one of the best, if not the best, trout fishing streams in the state. This trail would allow access to those areas, and would, you know, those people who are more involved in fishing versus bike riding or hiking could also use the trail. So this isn't just somebody who is going to get on a bike and ride, or wants to get out and enjoy nature hiking through the area. So again, it diversifies the region, gives more opportunities for others to use that area. And Mr. Hoffman also mentioned that it's been a joint partnership with the city of Preston. The city has invested $200,000 in cash. However, there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of hours that have been volunteered by local attorneys and other individuals in the area to acquire the land. The city did all the negotiating to acquire the rights of way, and the DNR eventually reimbursed the city for those cost. Same with the in-town trail, and you know, it's, again, it's a commitment that the city has had on its behalf. The DNR's committed to it. As again, Mr. Hoffman mentioned, it's a tier one trail, the destination trail. We see that as an important aspect of as a part of this. I think that ends my comments. I don't know if anyone has any questions for me or Mr. Hoffman.
Any questions? Representative Davids, any closing comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'd like to thank you for consideration. This is a beautiful area of the state, and we want to continue to expand the trail. And as was discussed, this is an existing trail. It's shovel-ready. The land is purchased, and we're ready to ride. Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 952 be laid over for future consideration. The bill is laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and we are adjourned.